You're joining us in front of the telly. Like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, Jacob.
Hey, Angel.
How are you?
I'm all right. just pulling up my tabs for what we're going to talk about today. How have you been? How's your week?
I have been exhausted and slow. Like walking through mud or quicksand like we thought we were going to be doing our entire adult life when we were kids. I don't know. I saw this meme where it was just like the TV from my childhood made me thought quicksand was going to be a problem. Because it's like every show, every
that's true.
Movie or whatever.
Quicksand came up 80s, a lot.
It came up a lot.
And I don't remember the last time I heard about it happening, existing, someone falling into it. Maybe we filled all of it.
I don't know. But yeah, I thought, you know, I thought quicksand was going to be more of a problem as an adult.
Because quicksand is one of my go-to, like, fables, if you will. Because the idea of the more you struggle, the worse you're making this whole situation.
Yeah.
And I actually apply that a lot to certain things or use that with people. Like, you know, dealing with trolls on the internet, it's like,
the more you comment, the faster you sink.
The more you engage, the worse it is for you. So just stop. Just be still. It'll go away.
Right.
They see with movement. yes. So you've had a quicksand week.
I've felt like I have been trying to move through quicksand. Mm. And so, like, you know, what you learn from these movies with quicksand is you have to go slowly. You can't struggle. And you just understand what you're dealing with and try to find a branch to pull you out, right?
Because isn't quicksand, it's not like it's actual moving sand.
Yeah.
But loose sand in a sinkhole. Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes it's gloopy and oatmeal-like. But yeah, so that's how I felt all week. And maybe it's new meds or maybe it's just, you know, time for me to take a break. I don't know. But it's been slow going and I've been exhausted.
I probably need to get some meds. I pay $400 a month for me to have health care. But I still live like I don't pay that $400. Like I'm so scared to go. It's like the cartoon of taking your car to the shop. You go in because you think your window's chipped, and then they want to. The next thing you know, your car has cancer in the lymphoma.
Your car has cancer.
Yep. And I got to do car chemo, and I don't want to do any of that. No, I need glasses. I'm past 40, so it's time for that colonoscopy. And I'm not looking forward to any of those things. I really do need to do the glasses thing, but that's part of laziness. My dad said the same thing. He's like, yeah, about 40 is when I needed glasses, but I didn't get them till 42. And that's where I'm 5 months away from that being the same story here. I am my father.
Oops, you became your father.
So what we are going to talk about this week is a little ditty.
A little.
From HBO Max.
4 hour. It took me like 2 months to watch.
Completely warranted. It's a slog.
Oh my God.
We watched the Rosario Dawson's DMZ on HBO Max. 4-episode miniseries. I think this is one of the most confused things I've ever seen that upset me so much. And then I had to go, I immediately went and read like the 75-issue comic book that it's based off of.
I 100% wanted to read the comic book. I finished it yesterday.
The show.
And the show. Like literally started trying to watch it 2 months ago and got to the end of the first episode and was like, nah,
it's rough.
And the only reason that, you know, like the only reason I watched it is because we're talking about it. I think that Yeah. It's
the politics. Here's what I've had to say this a lot lately. The politics are fucked. And not because they disagree with me. I can handle that. Then they'd just be wrong. But the politics are actually fucked, as in it doesn't know what it is.
Yeah.
And I am left alone sympathizing with the bad guy.
Who's the bad guy?
Parco. You've got Wilson, you've got Parco, and then Rosario eventually takes over from Wilson, basically. Mm-hmm. Wilson's side, okay, first.
Spoilers.
Premise and spoilers. I'm gonna try not to rabbit trail through the premise because the premise is fucked.
I mean,
everything doesn't have to happen.
Okay, the reason I wanted to read the comic book is I was like, there's no fucking way.
Oh yeah,
that this is what the comic book did.
What part?
The story that didn't make any sense.
I will say this: it is so far removed from the comic book.
Mm-hmm.
That if I was Brian Wood, I'd be upset.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that's similar to the comic book is it is the Manhattan, because everything has to happen in New York goddamn city. And not just New York City, the island of Manhattan.
Yeah, people.
The place that we bought for like 3 necklaces somehow is the center of the goddamn universe. Z is a character, not that character.
Mm-hmm. There is a character named Z in it.
Parco is a character.
Mm-hmm. Odie? Is Odie a character?
No. Neither is, by the way, Skell is the dumbest fucking name I've ever heard for an artsy assassin. Fuck you.
First of all, did they even explain? Because he's like, do you even know what that name means? And then she says, oh, it's your artist name. It came back, Dear Skell. When you get accepted into art school and whatever. Like, he was fucking 15.
Mm-hmm.
8 years ago. 12. I don't know. He was not 12. But he was 16.
Yeah, that kid who she lost in the first episode is not that dude.
No. But yeah, so she's talking about art school or whatever. And she knows Skell is the name he used. Did he even ever say, like, why that's his name?
No, I just assume because it's like almost saying skeleton. And you think skeletons are deadly.
Dumb.
Yeah.
Skeletons are deadly?
Well, they are dead.
They're dead.
Do you know you have a skeleton inside of you right fucking now?
Oh my god, what am I gonna do?
We have monsters with us. We're made of monsters.
We're comprised of monsters.
Anyway, Parco is a character. I would say out of all the characters, that's the closest.
To somebody that was...
To Parco in the book.
Oh, okay.
Wilson is in the book. He is so much cooler than whatever the fuck this gangsterized orderly is. This guy, this libertarian douchebag, who's raised by a Maoist. But what? Anyway.
Oh my god. Don't even... Okay, we do have to start from the beginning. We have to start from the beginning because the Tellies need to know the story. Right?
That's what I'm trying. So
go ahead.
I'm going to try to skip some stuff that I will come back later and touch on because I took some screenshots. So I read the book and I read interviews mm-hmm. in the omnibus trades that I found
mm-hmm.
where he talks about certain things that
the comic book writer.
Yes. That the show doesn't even sort of talk about. So like mm-hmm. the FSA,
mm-hmm.
it's very ambiguous.
What's and that? Free States of America?
Yes. The Free States of America. We're going to get into where they came from, how they got there, mm-hmm. what he thinks of them. But we're just getting to the premise. It's American Civil War II, and they're the Free States of America, which is the insurgent group in the U.S. government, have come to a standstill at certain parts of the country. A main point of focus, obviously, because it's so fucking important to the whole country, it's obviously a strategic landmass, the island of Manhattan. So this is the DMZ, the demilitarized zone. If you pay attention to North Korea and South Korea, there's a strip of land between both countries where no one's allowed to put anything because it's supposed to be neutral. That is called the DMZ as well. That is what the whole island of Manhattan is supposed to be, the DMZ. So when they closed it off at the beginning of the ceasefire years and years ago, the people were evacuated, but not everyone got out or not everyone wanted to leave. So these are the people that live within the DMZ. And because it's not only a demilitarized zone, it's also a no man's land, as in there's no formal government. So people sort of started putting together their patchwork enclaves. Mm-hmm. Within the show, this is a very different thing than it is in the book. And while I think the book has its structural problems, it does a fucking better job than the fucking show.
Okay.
In the show, you basically have, there's like seven factions, but we only pay attention to three of them. There's Parco's Latin Kings mm-hmm. group, of course, those with a lack of imagination.
Was it Harlem them, Kings?
Yes, Harlem Kings, you're right. Spanish Harlem Kings,
yeah.
People who don't...
Yeah, keep
people
going.
Who lack imagination are just going to have gangs form into these enclaves. So you have the Spanish Harlem Kings, Latin Kings or whatever. That's led by Parco, played by Billy Bragg, I think.
Benjamin Bratt. Billy Bragg.
I barely know anyone else's name. I was pretty close. Then you have so Chinatown, which is run by a guy named Wilson.
Wilson Lin.
Who now Parco was always in the Latin Kings, and so him being in charge of the Latin Kings was just the natural order that was there before. Mm-hmm. Wilson was an orderly who just so happened to have known and had a friends with benefit sleepover with Rosario Dawson, forming their relationship for when she comes in. We'll get to her in a second. He found some gold from a financial district guy, and he uses that to smuggle in resources to secure his position as king of or leader of Chinatown. Those are the two main factions that get all the other enclaves to sort of work with them, and that starts sort of the civil conflict within the demilitarized zone. There's also a group that sort of has stayed neutral or just on their own side. I don't remember their names. I know that they're led by SNL Hall of Famer Nora Dunn.
Mm-hmm.
Blessed be her. I'm a big fan. She was not in the comic book. They run like the monastery in New York, and they control her name all was the Una. So it starts the story. So that's the pieces on the board. And the story starts with, on evacuation day, Rosaria Dawson, who used to work at a clinic in Manhattan, was trying to take her like 15-year-old son to evacuate, but then they got lost, and just through the big crowd, she couldn't find him, and she ended up on the bus and got evacuated. The show starts with her trying to get back into the DMZ. Years later, again, I'm trying not to rabbit hole, but I totally could right there. Years later, she's going back to the DMZ to look for him. And while she's there, she gets involved in this conflict through the DMZ and becomes a power player all by herself for no fucking reason. And it ends with sort of like Rosario Dawson being like, Viva la Revolution. While, you know, in between the conflict of a insurgent group of 3%ers on one side and the U.S. government who has nuclear weapons on the other side. So she's probably going to do a really great job. If there was ever going to be a season two, which there absolutely is not. Thank God for small miracles. Before I go on any rabbit trails, I think I did a good job of laying it out. What do you have to say about this? What say you?
What say I? So the timelines don't make sense. She loses her son, and then 8 years later?
She says, I went in search for him all across the country.
All across the country.
and just as a last resort,
8 years later, let's go back to the place where I lost them.
What? Makes no sense. What the? Let's say. Oh, Jacob, it's very hard to get back into the DMZ.
Sure.
I understand that. Mm-hmm, but you know what? I would say, you know what? Cost benefit analysis, it seems like it might be easier to drive across country than it does to get into this. Guys, I nearly need you to look on Google Maps. This is a tiny parcel of land that supposedly is so strategic. But by the time I got to Tennessee, I'd be like, you know what? Fuck this. This is a very large country. I'm going to turn the fuck back around and try the last place I lost them. Like, what the fuck?
Well, I mean, they do say that you always find what you're looking for in the last place you look. So. Yeah.
No, that was real dumb.
I can even believe that it might have taken 8 years to find a way to get in and get out and, find the resources and the information to give her a starting point of where to look. And, he was a kid. Like, he was literally like 15 or 16 years old. Like, that child was not 18 and about to go to college by any stretch.
No.
Yeah, more. And then the guy who scale is 23, would make sense for him being 15 eight years ago. Anyway, so she goes looking for her son and runs into all kinds of things that she seems not to have known.
Even with this, a small parcel of obviously strategic piece of land, mm-hmm. there's 350,000 people on it. And somehow Rosario Dawson, through working through a downtown clinic, knows all of them.
All of them. All the major players.
Yes. Has some kind of connection, like, or an ability to make a connection with all the power players.
The small town I live in, mm-hmm. I still, like, I can watch the broadcasts of like our city council and mm-hmm. stuff like that. I don't think they're called city council. I can't remember what they're called. But I still don't actually know any of those people. I haven't run into them. I mean, like, I legitimately live in a small town.
Mm-hmm. And Macon was 90,000 people. This is three times that much.
Right. Right. And like, Macon is three times as big as where I live now.
There you go. You're and six even times living in smaller. A small
town, the people who are the power players,
mm-hmm.
I have no clue who they are.
Yeah.
If I were to come in search of, not my son, because no kids, but, whatever. It's not like I'm going to find any of my friends being, like, bosses.
Mm-hmm.
And every single person she knew was a boss.
Mm-hmm.
And she knew how to get in touch with all the other people and convince them somehow through dialogue in 4 hours. I mean, like seriously, the first episode was a 24-hour day.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next three episodes are a week.
I didn't pay attention to that. That's crazy.
Like, how the fuck? Okay, so, like, keep that in mind, the how the fuck, as we explain the more in-depth things that happen.
Now, my thing is, whenever I bring up like the politics are fucked, I get pushback with Jacob, it's just a show, let it alone. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, it's not like I'm watching Smallville and I'm bitching about the politics. Right. I'm talking about shows and stories that tell me, like, hey, I am political.
Yeah.
And this is a political show.
Yeah.
That's very political. Just like with Kingdom Come, I was last week, by the way, written by Mark Waid, not Kurt Busiek. Oh. I know that someone probably said, Jacob, they're superheroes. Yes, but it's also a political story. So I'm not inserting politics. I'm examining the politics are there. And the same thing with this story.
Yeah.
Now, to be fair to Brian Wood, he concocted this story in 2004. This is right after our invasion. We talk about this all the time. There's a historical and political context to all of these things.
Right.
And so in 2004, this is a year after we invaded Iraq. This is when people were already starting to turn on that and the Bush administration, just at the last minute, right before he got fucking reelected.
Mm-hmm.
And people, this guy was super disillusioned with that, to the point of, so in this world, in this universe, what happened was we started so many foreign wars that we didn't have anybody protecting the military bases here. Uh-huh. Which already is, that's cartoonish. Yeah. And so basically,
there's so many military bases here.
And so basically this, this 3%ers group, just started taking over the bases and doing a quiet coup by, looting, U.S. Army, arsenals and buying, they bought Chicago. But simultaneously, this is supposed to be a stand-in movement that's leaderless and is sort of just like, for any civil unrest within America, they would be of the Free States Army. So he never wants to sort of like pin down who they are.
Yeah.
Because then he might have to figure that out. But it's still like, what's disappointing about this? There's a couple things that are disappointing in this. This A shows the limitation of a liberal framework.
Okay.
And I'll get to that in a second. But the second part is like, I want to see, like, I love post-apocalyptic shit. Mm-hmm. I love political scrambles like a civil war within a context that I'm more familiar with, because I have to spend less time sort of like learning a different culture. Because there's civil wars all over this fucking country.
Civil wars are still happening.
But I've got to put it in their context. And so it's interesting when, like, what would an actual civil war in America look like? And so, like, I'm excited for that. I want to know, like, ooh, what would that be? And then when I find out, like, oh, you haven't thought any of this through, I'm like, A, this is a waste of time. Because how many times is Vertigo going to do another book about civil war? Right. How many times is HBO going to do another show about an American civil war?
Right.
So... it's not like you're wasting resources we don't have. You're wasting green lights. They're not just passing out. So super frustrating. Back to the liberal framework. What I find frustrating about a liberal framework is it's always so targeted. And what I prefer about a Marxist framework is most people already understand that a Marxist framework is all about the material conditions.
Okay.
But the other part that Marxism also talks about is he talks about structures and superstructures that hold up these systems that create these material conditions.
Exactly.
And so with a liberal framework like Brian Woods, he looks at like, oh, I'm so frustrated by all these foreign wars. Why are we always in these foreign wars? Fuck the Bush administration.
Right.
And so he starts a story and an analysis of what a possible play out of socioeconomic political situation would be, and he only looks at like certain things because he hasn't placed it within that superstructure.
Right.
It's not like
he's just at the base and then he doesn't do the superstructure of the politics that he's envisioning.
The economics, the cultural people, fights, the people, like none of that, all of those are interlocutors within a Marxist understanding of how structures and superstructures work. Mm-hmm. It's not like capitalism is just capitalism. And when he argues about capitalism, he's not also thinking of all the other things that is attached and the externalities that are created by those decisions based on capitalism. Just like when people look at historical... when people look at the Crusades, what we learned in high school, what we usually hear through a liberal framework is it was just a religious confrontation between a Muslim and a Christian nations, and they wanted to fight for the supremacy of their religion. Mm-hmm. Now, Marx would say that's not completely untrue, but actually also, at least in the realms of Christendom, they required more lands to fund their feudal projects that had to do with the material conditions with their own politics.
Right.
And so it's not just one aspect.
It wasn't just religion.
I'm probably not the best ambassador for these ideas because I'm still grasping them as well. So
you and me both.
To the listener, I'm probably just saying, oh, just add economics, but I'm not just saying that.
Right.
Because another thing Brian Wood and the show doesn't, the show tries to do, but in that weak representational way, Brian Woods really didn't do that well on the racial aspect of his story.
I don't think the TV show did either.
No, even but it drops phrases like it's trying.
Sure.
I'll let you finish what you're saying.
Well, so the thing that you're looking at in this show is that this is the island of Manhattan is basically a diverse, mainly people of color setup.
Mm-hmm.
That's who got left behind. It's Chinese, it's Hispanic, it's Black. You know, Una's white. And, you know, there's, you know, but it's not very many, you know, because Una says she was working. It's the working class,
mm-hmm.
first of all. It's the working class, and it's multi-ethnic. But, like, one of the things I hate it, and I'm going to say this, even though we have Afro characters, the main characters that we're dealing with are not Black people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like when we deal with Black people, like that was Scale putting down the one Black gang that wanted to kind of push back against Parco, right?
2-4 or 4-2 or
4-2, yeah, 2-4. I don't remember what they were. And because there's no need to remember,
mm-hmm.
the show doesn't care about them either. You know, no. Rosario Dawson is Afro-Hispanic.
Mm-hmm.
There was another Black character that is multi-ethnic as well, that we can talk about later. There were plenty of dark-skinned people, you know, populated throughout the show. It was, the first episode was directed by Ava DuVernay. But the Black representation isn't there.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the diversity of the cast.
Mm.
And I think that's telling. I think that there's something that's still being said in what the show was trying to do that is a thing that happens, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so why is it that the, you know, Asian guy has to be the one to die? Why didn't Parco die, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why is there no strong leadership within the Black held areas that would stand out and be one of the obvious choice for governors, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of daunting, you know, like basically I watched this on February 1st, the first day of Black History Month, mm-hmm. and I was very disappointed that, you know, we're looking at Afro-Indigenous, Afro-Latino people, but we're not actually looking at Black people, you know, who, you know, like, you know, what we're saying, the descendants of slaves here in, mm-hmm. from America, you know, here in America. And, you know, like, I don't want anybody to take that badly because, you know, Rosario Dawson may, for all I know, consider herself a Black person.
Mm-hmm.
And the other character who is played by, who was her name? Sydney Park. Her name's Tinny. You know, she may consider herself a Black person.
Is that Scale's love interest?
That's Scale's love interest, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, we did get Rutina Wesley, who I loved from True Blood.
Yeah.
Yes.
But there's no fucking way. I'm sorry. And I'm going to read some more stuff about the FSA. There's mm-hmm. no fucking way. Like, that was bullshit. But go on.
So, you know, like, pretty much the only Black person that we deal with that has any kind of power, and not even on a regular basis. We don't even meet her until the last episode.
She's another flavor imperialist.
And like, she's another flavor of imperialist. And it's like, how do you say we continue white supremacy even though we're a multi-ethnic, diverse group of people? You say it by putting this show on.
You like, have
in this place and time...
You have all these diverse people fighting over a piece of land that realistically, ultimately, they're not going to be able to keep because you've got two huge white forces trying to play them off each other
yeah.
through backwards deals that the mm-hmm. two people have any kind of power.
Yeah. Anyway.
Another big divergence. The book is completely different as far as story goes, because mm-hmm. what the book is about a guy named Matt Roth, who was a intern photojournalist who was going to follow around a well-known journalist through the DMZ, but their chopper gets attacked by an RPG and he crash lands in the DMZ and decides to just be an embedded reporter. Mm-hmm. So most of the stories, except for a couple of assorted issues throughout the 70 plus issue run, is following Matty Roth as he explores the DMZ and reports back to basically a Fox News stand-in called Liberty News.
Mm.
He works for them, which he got an internship from his dad, and his mom is also a political consultant.
Mm-hmm.
Tons of privilege going on here.
So much nepotism.
Definite nepo baby. And so that also, like, what sucks is, like, even with that, that would have been a way better story than this bullshit.
You know, but that story still sounds like it's being told from a white lens.
Oh yeah, no doubt.
Like, I think
no doubt. B, I still think that could be useful. I think that could still be useful to talk about that, to hold it up as an example.
Mm.
Because Z, the character Rosario Dawson, who Rosario is supposed to be from the book,
mm-hmm.
is Rosario Dawson's racial profile.
Okay. Afro-Latino.
Definitely brown. And she's constantly telling, like, having to reel in and not check his privilege per se. Because that, again, we talk about language, like when we talk about black and white, there are things mm-hmm. that people are trying to say that they didn't have the language for.
Mm-hmm.
We're definitely having that problem
okay.
with Z, but she's always the one trying to ground Matt and go, like, you don't know the city. You're still an outsider. Let me show you the ways of the city. Because supposedly, according to Brian Wood, Rosario's character is supposed to be like a personification of the city.
Mm.
You know how in old myths and fables, a person would sort of represent the spirit of an area or whatever? That's sort of her.
The magical Afro-Latino?
Didn't think about that, yeah. He even says, like, even though he considers her to be a real person, she has a real background, she's not magical. He likes the idea of the last time she shows up in a panel that she sort of just dissipates into the city. So yes, he definitely thinks of her as that magical.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. No, well, but there, I do remember what happens is I watch DMZ a month ago. I get mm-hmm. fucking excited about it. I have all these things. I tell Angel about it, and then it's 2 months later when we talk about it. I'm like, shit. And I tried rewatching it, but it's so hard.
It's so hard. I mean, I get it. I get it.
I remember a couple of the I remember them dropping a couple of lines of, like, saying the right things, but I don't remember what they were.
Oh yeah, I don't even know if they did really did that. So there's a couple of things that stood out to me mm-hmm. while watching this. First, we went from a very male-dominated political system to, at the end, it's all women.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, hopefully you noticed that, right? Mm-hmm. Z wins, Una's there.
And even Wilson's
mom. Aunt,
auntie.
Well, yeah, adopted mom.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause she kills his family and then takes him to the United States.
Maoist mama.
Oh my God, that whole thing about Mao. But I do kind of agree, you know, like, one powerful leader is, what did she say? One powerful leader is, they're all the same.
Yeah, she made
I wish some, I could remember what she actually said, because she
made some equivalency about absolute power corrupting and cult yeah. personality sort of all rolled up into one.
Right, and it doesn't matter who the powerful leader is, because she was somebody who got behind the powerful leader because she believed in him. But, like, really, they're all just men,
mm-hmm.
you know, who become corrupted. And the system that you thought you were supporting is corrupted as well. And like, I know that there are a lot of people who would say that, you know, does illustrate Mao based on the education that we receive here in the United States. And, you know, like what we get from the people that fled when Mao was in power. But like, why would you flee? Because you are one of the people that he was against, landlords and all that stuff. But anyway, I don't know as much. I don't know that much about Mao. I don't know if he was terrible or, you know, is just maligned because of the American politics or whatever.
I know more about Maoism than I know about Mao, but Mao, I plan to learn more about Mao.
But, you know, just that concept of the one dude in control becomes corrupted because power, that's where power leads you to corruption, right? And if you don't have a good, you know, whatever in mind. And like Rosario Dawson's character, like in literally a week, like she shows up one day. She hasn't been there in forever.
Mm-hmm.
She knows the two biggest players in the DMZ.
Oh yeah, I said her connection to Wilson, her connection to Parker is
they
her
used
son's
to be
dad.
Married. Yeah. They used to be together. I don't know if they were married, but yeah, that's her son's dad. Her son's name is Christian. So the whole time she's looking for Christian, right? We meet Skell really early in the show, and then we find out at the end of the episode that Skell is actually Christian. So now he's like a psycho killer maniac.
Yeah.
When he was her sweet baby boy 8 years ago. And when she finds out who, you know, Parco's son is, the guy who is, you know, like the killer, she goes back to the DMZ as opposed to going home like she was supposed to after 24 hours in the DMZ.
Also, as a bad story, I think the assumption is he's mad at her because she left him.
Mm-hmm.
But it ends up being like he was mad at her the entire time, like even before they left.
He'd been mad at her.
And it was because she dropped a dime on Parco and he got mad about it.
He told her something that he thought she would keep because he, you know, she asked him to tell him everything and he did. And then she used the fact that he told her that he had an unregistered gun to get Parco put in jail. And the day he got put in jail was the day that all hell broke loose. So he was stuck in jail. The girl that he was with at the time told her when she shows up at the door, banging on the door, like all demanding. It's just like, the fuck, Rosario Dawson? Like, can you ring the doorbell like a decent human being?
Like, I'm here to see my son. Lady, it's been 8 years. Where the fuck have you been?
Can you say hello?
You ain't in that much of a hurry.
So, you know, she tells her that he was in jail for a week with no help or anything because the police officers left. And her son, who, you know, like loved his dad, was afraid of his dad, but loved his dad, you know, told her something that she used against the man that he loved, you know, and he was mad, like a 15-year-old would be. And then that turned him into Skell.
Deadly Batman, artistic assassin.
Artistic assassin.
Like, oh yeah, because he's got a heart of gold. He does art.
Yeah.
He's a romantic spirit who kills people without any empathy.
But yeah, no. So in that time, 24 hours, she turns back around. And then in a week, she is running the DMZ. She wins an election in the DMZ.
Which is, an election that, like, I mean, who certifies this? How does anybody, what compels anyone? Like, again, it's not like this show was made before January 6th. Mm-hmm. But I think January 6th should get people to recognize, like, there are systems that are in play. Like, you can't just have who gives a fuck? You're in the DMZ, Rosario Dawson gets all the votes, but you have all the guns. Who gives a shit? Like, that's the failure of liberal takes. Like, who gives a shit? Like, I'm not saying I want that to be how things work. I'm right. just saying, no, that's that, how things
like, work. Like, technically, right now, that's how things work. He who has the biggest guns, right? Because that's what we're all fighting about. Nobody wants to give up their guns because he who has the biggest guns, like, who's going to listen to somebody talking about how they should be their better self when they can't even be their better selves when everything is okay? Mm-hmm. We're talking about a fucking revolution, a fucking everybody's cut off, and she talks people into being their better selves.
Look at,
like, they've been in there for 8 years. Why didn't they do that by themselves? Why did they need Rosario Dawson to do the speechifying?
Part of leftist education is learning about coups, revolutions, and every single time the loser lost the military. Either through backhanded funding, usually by us, or some other deal. They didn't solidify the control or backing of the military, and that's what fucked them. Allende, the socialist president of the Democratic Socialist president of Chile, didn't have the fucking military. He got gat. That's the only one I can think of right now, but like, he got the military. So I mean, it already is like, and that's why I say too, like, when you hear people talk about there's no such, I keep repeating this take because I don't think we are sold this liberal, we are given a lot of liberal slogans that are just said as if they are came down from God. Like, there's nonviolent protest is the only useful protest. And I repeat again, the only reason why MLK could do nonviolent protest is because it was within a jurisdiction of democratic control that was fought for by violence. So I, in my opinion, you don't get the nonviolence without doing it within a space that was fought for, controlled by, with violence. Right. So like, this whole idea, like, they're gonna have an elect, who gives a shit?
Well, but the other thing is, MLK also knew that violence wasn't just violence for violence sakes. Violence was the language of the unheard. Mm-hmm. And he knew that people reacted violently when they were not listened to.
Yeah, I was listening to a civil rights activist in Atlanta. He's a talk about Cop City. And he mm-hmm. was talking about how he's anti-violence, not a pacifist, because he does support defending yourself if you are attacked, but he's not going to open with it. And I think that's an attitude we should have. And so it's like, the liberal mind's going to say, well, we had an election, who gives a shit, I don't care. Like, the lady in control of the water, she decides the election panned out, then okay. But I mean, this is also what we talk about when we talk about material conditions. Mm-hmm. Like, this idea of democracy, it still has to be backed up and justified with material conditions. And that's right. Either control of a resource or control of violence.
Right. And
it's a monopoly of violence.
And D got everybody that had the resources.
Exactly.
Z.
And the reason why I say I actually, and I did this in a book too, and they made him out to be a super bad guy. I actually sympathize with Parco. Now, we talked about how there's Parco and there's Wilson, and those are the mm-hmm. two main fights, and they do have an ideology behind them.
Yeah.
I'll start with Wilson's. Wilson's is total libertarian. He wants everyone to stay in their own enclaves, control themselves.
Do their thing,
which I'm not saying doesn't sound good, except mm-hmm. Parco's idea is, no, we need to come together as a unified DMZ mm-hmm. so that we can come to the bargaining table with these much larger entities.
Right.
I'm sorry, that's the smarter fucking play. Like, you don't have to give up your sovereignty within your district to form a full island government. Right. But I think it's more... it's more practical for, say, the U.S. to want you to be in your little enclaves,
right?
And then pick you off one by one. Just like being in a union versus going to your boss by yourself.
Thank you. I was just going to say that. The collective voice and everybody speaking as one voice is more solid than the individual voices all speaking together, even if they say similar things, because they're not going to all say the same thing. Apparently there's cannibals in the 8 years they're eating fucking eating people.
Well, evidently cheetahs just let kids walk by them, so that was awesome. Sorry, I did try to watch. I got like 15 minutes. I got to that part. Like, that cheetah, if there's anything I know about wild animals, they're always cold and hungry. Odie's gone. That kid's
over. Easy to pick off. Like, come on.
He's adorable, and I love him in the show.
He was adorable, and I loved him. And if anything happened to him, I would have thrown something at the TV. However,
that cheetah's having
He should have been dead. He should have been dead a long time ago.
I loved the thing with the grandpa, though.
Oh.
I love Odie.
I love Odie, too. And his friend Nico. When she does the standoff with the boys, the gun. And he says, apologize. Yeah, I thought they were going to get the shit beat out of him. And then she pulled out that gold gun. And I was like, damn, Nico.
I love how she didn't take shit off those kids.
I loved it, too. And, you know, she legitimately was worried about little Odie when Parko got a hold of him. He was so dumb, though.
Parko?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, why in the hell? I mean, you have a mass power. You've convinced people to speak as one voice. You have weapons. You know, even if you're fucking making deals with the United States government for whatever reason, right? Mm-hmm.
I know I said that the U.S. would want to pick them off one by one, but I know that they backed Parko and the Free States backed Wilson. Mm-hmm. Again, this show's not fucking perfect. So even though that's what I said would happen, doesn't mean that the show's going to agree with me.
Even when they did that, the show didn't agree with you. how do you not understand, like Rosario Dawson does very quickly, and like everybody watching, I hope, that if Parko were to go and set off bombs in front of FSA, that the United States would, you know, take over because the ceasefire is gone. So now the demilitarized zone is militarized, and then you lose everything.
Well, that's the thing,
because like you, the fucking United States,
they made. They talked about their politics with Mama Mao about how, well, if you have one person in charge, if you have concentrated power, that power is going to corrupt the person, which is why the show doesn't want Parko to be the good guy.
Right.
But, which is why they're stupid. I mean, when Brian Wood describes the FSA, I want to read this.
Okay.
The interviewer says, I've read reviews that tend to project their own idea of the FSA, sometimes just dismissing them as a redneck militia from the red states, which it often is.
That's why you say Retina Wesley would never have been the leader of it.
Yes. Okay. For the record, what is the FSA? And this is Brian Wood's answer. So this is what he's thinking. And again, I know the show is not written by Brian Wood. I don't even know if he consulted on it, but I do know that they're starting, his idea is the germ. Mm-hmm. So anything, any hole they don't fill in, I got to go to him for.
Right.
So his answer is FSA, Free States of America, has always been more of an idea than a standing army. It's the idea of resistance, popular civilian uprising, rather than soldiers in uniform. The FSA is fluid in its actions and motivations, nearly impossible to point a gun at and kill. I've consistently shown the FSA starting in the Midwest or Montana, and that does play into the redneck stereotype. Early on, I saw the FSA being born out of the survivalist movement,
which is still
super racist, super racist, super conservative, super 3%er. These are 3%ers. These are the people that were running up on Jan 6.
Like, listen, if you looked at, I mean, like, these are the people who have their go bags ready right now, who feel like they could survive if there was an apocalypse because they have a root cellar that has all these things in it that they can go to and hide out, or
buckets of powdered peanut butter, buckets of it.
And if you don't understand who those people are, then you're not telling the story as accurately as you can. you have to understand where the people are coming from. Like, why would you pick the Montana people? Like, mm-hmm. remember when they, I don't know if it was Montana, it might've been Wyoming, but they took over the,
that was in Oregon, the wildlife reserve.
Yeah.
The Bundy guy.
Yeah.
That was here. That was
out
here.
God. Yeah. Oregon. Okay. That's the guys. Those mm-hmm. are the guys that he's making the FSA based
off of. Ruby Ridge was in Idaho.
Yeah. So like you don't understand where these people are coming from. So then you can put whatever politics into their mouths and it doesn't fit. And that's why the story doesn't get told the way that it needs to be told. And that's why the story is all over the place. That's why you don't have any convincing like ideology behind mm-hmm. what you're saying. There's like no material collection of the information put together and dispersed out in this new environment that you're trying to create. Like you basically said, what if Civil War? And then you said, well, who would be on the opposite sides? The actual United States of America. And then the guys who think that they're preppers, you know, ready to take over the world. They don't want to get rid of their guns because they think they can take on the U.S. Army if the end of the world goes down. Like those motherfuckers are who's going to be doing all this stuff and holding the USA off. Like, are you fucking kidding me? You know, okay. So I get why you would say, okay, there's so many wars going on. Like, do you know how many military people we have? Like, do you know how many people we already have out there and the so many wars that's going on? Because we're like literally doing the so many wars right now. And you just don't read about it. Okay, like I'm getting heated.
There's more too. Early on, I saw the FSA being born out of the survivalist movement, which mm-hmm. is neither red nor blue. I did research, of course.
Uh-huh.
No, you didn't. But okay, there's something else you need to know about Brian Wood's background because I looked mm-hmm. it up. He's from Vermont, and he's an art kid who went to art school because he's also an artist. He did most of the covers at the beginning of the run, and then someone else took over.
So I'm
he's also
guy,
an artist.
Right?
So he's an art kid who went to art school in NYC, but is from Vermont. He even moved to San Francisco, hated it, moved back. This motherfucker loves New York City.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this white kid from Vermont just don't know. Like, he just don't know shit.
Mm-hmm.
I did my research, of course, but soon after, I evolved it into more of a national concept. When I was winding down the commander, that's basically the character that the True Blood lady played.
Retina, yeah.
I wanted to show his origin. He was a favorite. One I deliberately tried to write contradictory. He's all over the place in terms of ideology. No, he's not. He's a weapons runner who mm-hmm. finds out that a bunch of rednecks are trying to take over the country, and he decides that it's opportunistic for him to do so. He's a pot-smoking, long-haired defender. Yeah, like, these people also smoke pot. And, like, Charlie Daniels has a song about how he was getting picked on for being a long-haired... Leave this long-haired country boy alone.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's not... Like, you're so fucking Vermont, you don't even know that still falls within the category of a Republican. There was a hold on. There was another.
I mean,
part
like where. That's there's a level of racism there too. It's just like, or you know, like classism anyway, because it's just like you know who are long hairs, pot smokers, New Yorkers.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously they would not be survivalists, but I'm making those survivalists, those people survivalists. They're part of the survivalist group. That's how you know that they're not rednecks or racists or whatever, you know. And it's like, dude. Do you know how many racist, long hair, pot smoking survivalists there are?
Mm-hmm.
Probably all of them, but you know, who? I don't know.
I'm trying to. There's a part where he basically said, where he really. Oh, here it is. I also have, and we can read more of this, the pitch of DMZ that he has written out.
Mm-hmm.
I do want to read this whole thing that says the background, and this will touch on the FSA as well.
Okay.
DMZ takes place in a fictional near future, definitely inspired in large part by the current Bush administration and its efforts overseas. Again, written in 2004. The United States is in a state of civil war. While the military and National Guard are busy overseas, why would the National Guard? Does it? Anyway, a strong and determined militia rises up from the middle states and begins to take over. They call themselves the Free States or the Free Armies and support the same core desire as always, a small government that leaves the average citizen alone, libertarian, not one that spends trillions fighting pointless wars overseas and cracks down on basic freedoms at home, liber-fucking-tarian. The Free Armies spread, gaining ground and support, and it's a largely bloodless insurgency until it hits the major population centers on the east and west coasts and is halted by hastily returning U.S. troops. So, by the way, this also means the intelligence community
suck. They don't know what they're doing. They should all lose their jobs.
And they wait till like after half the country's gone to go, oh shit, we need to get our troops back. This is where the war begins, on the edges of New York and L.A.
Did Portland, you say that they were mainly, they did not have a, they were leaderless?
Yes, in another thing they talk about, because the commander character is trying to tell a couple of them, like, let's go to the Lincoln Tunnel and defend it so we can set up our own portion. And one guy's like, we don't have, we're not a cult of personality, we don't have a leader. You can't tell us what to do. It's like, yeah, so they this somehow group,
still seems to work in concert together. Because it's just like, it sounds like there would just be a whole bunch of shitheels taking over silos and military bases and then setting up their own fiefdom there, as opposed to working in concert and being together and forming themselves as the Free States of America.
Yeah, small government motherfuckers who just want the government to leave them alone are gonna, right, like, but start they're anew.
Guarding the Lincoln Tunnel so that they can.
Anyway, it's dumb. It's a dumb liberal take because he's only paying attention. He can only because they can only hold so many, and it's not that they're stupid, because it does take a lot of brain power to try to juggle these balls instead of putting them in their place within the observation of the systems. Anyway,
well, nobody wants to point out the systems that they observe, because either they don't see it because, you know, they're what's the name, Maddie, whatever, the guy who is in the comic book that Matt Roth. They're either Matt Roth that got everything through nepotism and knowing people, and, you know, like, things don't really work badly for them because there's always somebody that can catch them if they fall. Mm-hmm. That's the concept. Or they're, you know, like Parco, who is like, you know what? This is the only way that we can do anything. We have to get some leverage. We have to get the people together. We have to do it through violence or go or money or whatever. Mm-hmm. We got to bribe them or scare them. And this is the only way that it's going to happen. Right. I mean, and even though Lynn Wilson was the libertarian branch of that, because that's why the FSA is on his side versus the United States being on Parco's side. You know, like, even though that is the case, it's like that isn't even really examined, because what he does is the same thing. Mm-hmm. They're the exact same person, which, you know, of course, Rosario Dawson finds out the hard way. And then she's the same thing. Mm-hmm. But somehow she's better.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just, it was just, it just felt like.
It's muddied.
It's too muddy. It's not fully examined. And like, you're trying to take on something like this. Like, it's hard to fully examine it from in any perspective. I'm a Black woman who. It looks at everything from a Black perspective because I can't help it. Mm-hmm. And like, I try to understand white perspectives, but like, I literally listen to somebody talk about their job and what their supervisor is doing to make their job harder. And it's like, I don't get that. I don't understand like that kind of behavior and, you know, an attitude or anything like that. Right. And so it is a hard thing to tackle and to think about and to try to do, you know, but for anyone. And then what they do with something that was poorly put together is make it worse. Like, that's what the TV show did, you know? So like, maybe the comic book is a better read with that has its issues, but the TV show was bad.
It was, I mean, so like, bad.
You know, I thought Benjamin Bratt was amazing in it as his character.
He chewed up some scenery.
He had so much fun playing Parco. He was ready to take his clothes off and fight. You know, he was ready to say the speeches and have the things. He was ready to go after Rosario Dawson with a gun and shoot, you know, the shit out of her. But like, how they developed that relationship, how he was with his son. I mean, like, actually, probably the realest thing was the familial relationship that, you know, they portrayed. Mm-hmm. You know, probably the realest thing was how he felt as a person meeting the person he wanted to be with, right? Mm-hmm. Like, those emotional moments, those are the things that really connected. The fucking politics was terrible. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just like, none of this makes sense. I'm really sick of this. And the fact that it has a happy ending? Mm-hmm. Are you fucking kidding me? Like, of anything, this shouldn't have a happy ending. Of anything I've watched, I love a happy ending. I want a happy ending for almost everything. But of anything that I've watched, the one thing that should least likely have happened was a happy ending in this show.
I do want to say for the book, I think what it does do a good job of doing is it does do a good job of trying to just talk about the realities of war.
Mm-hmm.
And evidently there have been a good bit of veterans who read the book and mm-hmm. who were deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan who did also find a connection on that level.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why Brian sort of fucks up a lot of the rest of the stuff, because it's almost like, I think that was his focus. Like, this book for him was a lot about
the military,
the war, the military, and the military spending, and the Bush foreign affairs agenda.
So did they go more into Parco being a soldier in the book?
No, he was not a soldier. He was a Latino guy who rose up and started becoming a populist leader. In fact, I've got where did the interviewer asks, where did the charming and dangerous Parco Delgado originate? Let me give a little bit more of the story. So Parco becomes a populist leader. He does speak on a racial level that I think is pretty good. He gets everyone together. Mm-hmm. He hires Matty Roth, loves what he's doing. He loves what he stands for. He loves what he's saying. Mm-hmm. So Matty Roth decides to stop being an unbiased reporter.
Mm-hmm.
I think also too, Brian Wood does do a good job of talking about bias,
okay,
in reporting and in specifically, of course, war reporting.
Oh yeah.
So
his biggest focus then was more about war and how much the U.S. was going to war.
He's very critical. The U.S. is not a good guy in this book at all. In fact, they commit a war crime that they blame on other people, that they blame on Parco, actually, because Parco has an election. Brian Wood also does not like Blackwater. So there's a stand-in for them as well.
Okay.
Blackwater tries to fuck up the election and intimidates people not to vote. So they do an election in the DMZ, like in the show, except pretty much there's like Parco's the only, I don't remember who else was running. Oh, I think it was like literally like either let the U.S. take control or let Parco be the leader of all of this or something like that. It's been a long time. Parco wins. And Parco's next move after getting everyone consolidated under one ruling umbrella is he finds a way to buy a nuclear device. This is told from the book's point of view as like the worst thing in the world he could have ever done.
Right.
But like, I'm sorry. What the fuck else do you want him to do? Again, go look at a map of the United States, find Manhattan, and tell me why anybody who splits up that big ass 350 million person country should listen to whatever this fucker has to say, unless he does have something to actually leverage.
Yeah.
Like, this is why countries like North Korea nuke up. So you can't just fucking invade their asses.
Mm-hmm.
And after the Soviet Union falls, fuck, what else are they supposed to do?
Right.
So it's like, they make it out like this is the biggest supervillain move he could have made, even in the interviews and shit. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, what the fuck? This makes the most sense. Why am I always, like, I know that, like, some asshole would say, like, Jacob, maybe the reason why you always side with the villain is because you're an asshole.
I mean,
but
they're
no.
not wrong.
But no, like, that's what he should be doing. Anyway.
Right, right. Then if he's trying to be an actual world power, then he has to have something that will force them not to. I mean, because, like, it's the United States. And, he, like, literally, you're right. The island of Manhattan is tiny.
So small.
And so, like, what is stopping them from going in and shooting up as many people and taking it over, right?
I got a 4-pound puppy, and if you walked up and said, I want you to listen to me, I have a voice and I'll be heard. And let me tell you something, if I don't like what he has to say, I'm going to kick the shit out of him. I just kick him. I'm not going to kick my puppy, I'm just saying.
Oh my God, you are the villain.
So then in the book, it becomes about the hunt for the nuclear device.
Mm.
U.S. finds it, they mm-hmm. drop bombs on it.
Because that
it
makes
explodes,
sense. Mm-hmm.
They blame Parco.
Mm.
Oh, this guy, he's a terrorist. This brown guy who decided to stand up to the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
terrorist.
I mean, that is appropriate. That is exactly what the U.S. would do. I mean, that's making fucking sense. You know, that makes way more sense than anything, almost anything that happened in the TV show.
So, again, this is what Brian Wood says about that character. Where did the charming and dangerous Parco Delgado originate? And he says, if there was a single inspiration for Parco, it would be Hugo Chavez. With a dash of Che Guevara. And then a bit of Al Sharpton. White boy from Vermont. I was looking for a populist guy that would inspire fanatical devotion from the downtrodden and dispossessed. I love how that's how we're describing our bad guy. But still be part of the system. And still be a political figure. I loved writing the two of them together, Maddie and Parco. You can say, so he gets elected and immediately, and he uses Maddie to help sell his message. And as soon as he gets elected, Maddie's mother steps in, who's like this, like, so his dad works for Fox News and his mm-hmm. mother is a political consultant. Mm-hmm. She's a liberal political consultant. So then she starts to work for Parco. Just she wants to piss everybody off.
Mm-hmm.
And then Parco stops talking to Maddie. And so then Maddie gets a little pissy. Like, I thought I was best friends with Parco. Mm. So I guess.
Get this guy elected.
Yeah. he just whines about it.
Mm-hmm.
There's more to Maddie's story that's really bad and makes Maddie a piece of shit, but I'm just trying to stick to Parco.
Wait, you didn't consider him a piece of shit from the beginning as a nepotism hire? And the.
He can't help being a nepotism hire, but no, like, he gets people killed.
I mean.
He's not being. Like, that's just him being shitty and bratty.
I mean.
So. I have a hard time seeing how Parco, besides getting this high profile consultant, how he becomes a part of the system. But that means I'd have to understand what Brian Wood considers the system.
Yeah.
When he would
well,
probably
he's a
call
part of
Bernie.
The system. He was a part of the system because he went straight to nuclear weapons as his means of
true.
You know, whatever, right?
He went down a normal route.
Yeah.
Of a country that has, like, again, like, it's a mirror brain. That's what people call it. Like, they're just, their American brain is broken. Mm-hmm. Like, we're absolutely the good guys. We absolutely stand for democracy. It's like, no, the fuck we don't. Again, yeah. It might doesn't make right, but might's gonna, like, answer all the questions. Like, might's gonna, like, might does not make right. I am not saying that, but I'm saying might is going to get things done.
Mm-hmm.
Again, like, I'm not saying it's how the world should be. I'm talking about how the world is. It's not a prescriptive statement. It's a descriptive statement. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, if you're a tiny ass fucking nation and people are calling you a fucking terrorist, then yeah, you're going to get a fucking nuke. Brian Wood says, I heard this once in reference to Iraqi insurgency, insurgents. All an insurgency has to do is win. All an insurgency has to do to win is not lose. The burden's always been on the U.S. to act. It's not until Parco and the nuke that they have a clue how to do that. They didn't know what to do with Parco until he got a nuke. The only thing they could think to do was subvert him. I don't, you know, that was a dumb thing to read.
Yep.
So,
but yeah.
Yeah, it's a story that I think DMZ is worth reading. It has a lot of good moments. There's some cool elements to the story, but I do think it is a half filled out picture. Mm-hmm. And then you Xerox, you know, it's Xeroxing a copy of a copy. And then the show, I don't know where this must have fallen apart in the studio, the C-suite.
I feel like there's a lot of things that are crazy about this show, right? The first thing is, she's trying to get him out of the DMZ. But like with Parco gone, and Parco's second in command dead.
Caesar.
Yeah. What would be staying in the DMZ do?
All of his bad influences are gone.
Yeah.
And you don't and the rest of the country is in the middle of a civil war,
and she is about to become the leader that mm-hmm. and everybody's like living off of her inspirational speeches, right?
Yeah.
Let's take care of each other. Okay, so she sends her son to the world that was created after the Civil War, that is a duplicate replication of the world before the Civil War. He's an artist, she's a musician. What the fuck they gonna do?
Yeah. He'd be a mercenary, I guess. He's got a particular set of skills.
He's gonna work for Blackwater.
Yeah. Now, evidently in the comic book, a fan favorite character is Wilson.
Okay.
Who is not a libertarian a-hole. he starts out as Maddie's kooky neighbor who helps him with his tech, mm-hmm. because Maddie strikes a deal with Liberty News saying he'll stay here if they send him supplies, mm-hmm. and he'll send them the story. So they send him like a laptop and a cell phone and stuff like that, mm-hmm. which he usually immediately ditches because he's like, there's tracking shit on this. Mm-hmm. There's surveillance stuff all over this, no doubt. And Wilson is the one who sort of helps him deal with that. Then it comes out that Wilson's actually like moonlighting as his neighbor, and he's actually the leader of the Chinatown gang.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a cool thing that really could have been part of the show.
He was actually a low-level gangster, mm-hmm. but then everyone died. And he just rose to the occasion. It's one of those mm-hmm. things where, you know, great men don't make history, but history can make great men deal.
Okay.
He did have a shit ton of gold. I don't remember how he got it. Mm. But that was the thing from the book, where he had it all over the place, and he would use it to get favors if he needed it to, or to pay for items he wanted smuggled in. Mm-hmm. And eventually he sacrifices himself and becomes a hero for Chinatown. They love him. They love him. Mm. Which I think, you know, is also seen in the show.
Yeah.
But he's not like faking it like the guy in the show. But from the show, I sort of did like how he would turn that on and off, and how he'd make fun of his own bodyguard. Like, her name's Jessica. Calm down.
I was just trying to think of my favorite thing that happened in the series, though, that I kind of think should be a part of every post-apocalyptic thing. And I do like this for, like, what it really would have been, right? Mm-hmm. The security guard for a museum is now crazy. And living in a tent in a building somewhere.
Yes.
But he took all the paintings. I mean, it's the museum, so the MoMA. He takes the paintings from that and hides it and puts it up because of how important it is. He's like, you know, basically these cretins that were going to make it kindling for firewood, he kept them from doing that. So there's mm-hmm. Starry Night and, you know, like all these other things by great artists. That's in a tent and the kids go and just stare at art. And I love that Starry Night was one of them because Odie reveals that he really just likes looking at the stars. It was such a good, sweet moment. And one of the things I like about post-apocalyptic shows, those little things that you don't think of when it's the end of the world, mm-hmm. and you find yourself suddenly find yourself in the midst of beauty because there's someone who cares about it like you would. You know, would have cared about it. You know, one of the things I found completely and totally unrealistic is Tenny's being the radio person and no one ever having found that radio station.
Yeah. Two things to those. First off, that story is in the book of someone hoarding, less than daring though, of someone hoarding all the art, mm-hmm. preserving the art. It was actually a rich dude
who got left.
Who stayed behind specifically to take care of the art. Like, he went and systematically put the art in this old house and then, like, was about to die. And so he contacted Matt to come and witness that the stuff was all here and then mm-hmm. gave him the instructions on what to do with it after he died, mm-hmm. after he passed away.
Oh, okay.
So not as endearing as, like, I'm a security officer and I just love looking at these every day, but that was still in there. And then there's actually a couple of issues where Brian does, again, we talk about what liberals fixate on, and one of the things liberals of red and blue stripe, because mm-hmm. here they're all liberals to us, is culture. And so there's actually a very booming underground art scene. And like this character decades later, that's his name, that's his tag name. He mm-hmm. there, he gets his own little story. There's famous DJs.
Hmm. I mean, it was Manhattan, so that, appropriate.
It's like this one issue where it's like, it looks like a brochure of if you were a tourist in the DMZ, where the hot spots, the diners that you should, like, he breaks format to do this. And I think he also did the art for this one too, mm-hmm. to break the format up a little bit.
I mean, that's pretty cool though.
It is cool. Like, I'm just saying, but of course the liberals going to make sure to touch on culture shit.
I mean,
we're just talking about how he focuses on different things.
Yeah. But I mean, like, overall, DMZ was terrible.
It was bad, even as a story.
I lost 4 hours of my life. I got fucking mad. It was the one time. I mean, like, I mean, that's why I watch Christmas movies. I want the happy ending. I want the fucking syrupy, mm-hmm. everybody lives and everybody gets what they want and da da da, right? And I was just like, this is not the story to do that. Yeah. Like, literally, this was not the story to do that. I hated it.
It was some and, Western shit.
If you liked it, you're a serial killer. No, I'm just kidding. If you liked it, if you liked DMZ, I would love to hear what you liked about it.
Yeah.
You know, go to the Facebook page, you know, be like, Angel and Jacob, you're wrong.
It's DMZ gotta be was dummies.
Terrible. I don't think that they have to be dummies. I just think that they watched it without the lens that we watch it through. Because I feel like there are some things that might be better if we didn't watch it with our lens. I think this was terrible and it didn't need our lens for it to be terrible. No. But
it's fun to apply it because I think it's a good, especially why I focused on the book too. Mm-hmm. Because when I first saw it, I was like, these politics are so fucking stupid. So I yeah. went and read the book because I was like, is the book this bad? Is the book
as stupid as this? Yeah.
Is Brian Woods just as bad at politics? And he is not this bad. It's like a spectrum, and he is not that bad.
He's not quite as in the hole as they are, but yeah.
But again, part of my project, and especially on the show, is to show how to apply this lens and show the failings of, like I said, a liberal framework. Mm-hmm. And the superiority of a Marxist one. I'm smarter. That's all I'm saying.
No, I'm not saying I'm smarter. I'm joking. This is how I look at things and, you know, and examine them. And, you know, I was talking to my husband about it because he was just like, what is this garbage? And I was just like, I couldn't agree with you more. I'm mad that I'm not watching Star Trek Discovery. And I know there are people that don't like Star Trek Discovery, but my rewatch of it is just like, this show I love. Yeah. Like, I don't think I felt like I loved it when I watched it the first time. But actually, I mean, I'm still just in the first two seasons. But
especially the part you're at, it's still really good.
Yeah. So, anyway.
No, yeah, though. I mean, yeah, if you disagree with us, please, of course, go to Facebook and search In Front of the Telly and join our group where the show is happening when the show's not happening. And yeah, tell us why we're wrong.
I would love to hear the, you know, like the approach of why the show is good to you. I mean, don't get me wrong, there was some good acting in it, but overall, like the storyline, the outcomes, the reasonings.
It's just frustrating too because of Rosario Dawson, right? Like for the longest time, she was almost like a nerd darling. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it makes sense she'd be in a comic book adapted thing. Yeah. But then it's like, yeah, but this is bad.
Yeah, and all she's doing is yelling and walking around the city.
Like, this is the most Cory Booker show you've ever done.
You will not malign Cory Booker during Black History Month.
I won't.
No. No, white man, you will not.
You can, yeah, look. You can quantify whatever that means. But I am not wrong in saying that this is the most Cory Booker show.
100% not wrong.
Yeah, like, oh, God. She's been so disappointing. It's just been, she peaked at 2016 for me, and it's just been disappointing since. I hope her Jedi show isn't bad.
Ahsoka?
Yeah.
Oh, I did like her in what little we saw of her. In what's the other show?
She did like a Coen-esque brother show where she goes to like New Mexico and solves a crime.
No, what I mean is, wasn't it the other Star Wars show that the Mandalorian showed up in and made it like 10 times better?
Oh, Boba Fett.
Boba Fett, like, wasn't it his part of Boba Fett that she was in? Or was it actually the Mandalorian?
I think she was I think she helps him find the temple for like 3 minutes. Like for a length of time, it didn't justify her having to paint her whole body orange.
Right.
Okay. It wasn't a lot.
Okay.
It wasn't a lot.
Okay. Okay, that makes sense. So we see her in the Mandalorian where she is.
Yeah, going then she has that one episode where she goes after the. I think I'm pretty sure.
Okay. That makes sense.
So, but she's and I haven't seen, I don't know, does she show up in Clerks 3? I still haven't seen that yet. I know she was in Clerks 2.
I don't know.
Yeah. Talk about someone else who fell off. Where have all my wet men gone?
Kevin Smith Black and Joss History Month, we don't care.
Kevin Smith and Joss Whedon just don't excite anybody as much as they used to.
Did they excite people? I know they did because I am a Firefly stan.
Thank you.
I still would watch Firefly if Joss Whedon redid it. So
I think it's confirmed the Nevers is done.
The Nevers is done. I think it's off HBO Max. Like they may, it's one of the ones that they may sell to somewhere else.
I want to briefly touch on. Do you have anything else to say about DMZ?
No, bad. Don't watch it.
Yeah, I definitely say like don't walk, don't run, turn around, delete. Like if all the things that HBO could have deleted, that there's no way it made the money.
First of all,
there's a write off.
I feel like they could have kept, even if it got bad in the last seasons. What's the one with the robot people?
Westworld.
I think we could have kept Westworld and gotten rid of,
That was so frustrating.
And gotten rid, because I haven't watched the last episode.
It had a following. You would have gotten, it's.
Like, okay. Anyway, I mad about it. Made mad about it. Anyway, yeah, DMZ, like literally if it was like, what should you do with HBO Max because DMZ exists? Delete HBO Max. Okay, what are your plugs?
I'm still getting my stuff together. Hopefully I should have my next sticker. I told Stephanie that I would have whatever I have up in a store to sell by Valentine's Day. So if you're hearing this after Valentine's Day, I don't know what to tell you. We're puppy propaganda. That's the current, that's what the name we're landing on right now, because we're going to do puppies and protest sign stickers.
Oh, nice.
So either puppy or puppy propaganda. Sorry, what were you saying?
I was just saying we want propaganda stickers for, you know, the revolution. Mm-hmm. Viva. And then, of course, you can find us on Facebook at In Front of the Telly. Jacob puts a lot of stuff out there. There's a lot of conversation going on. I just add memes that make me laugh. And us elsewhere on the interwebs at In Front of the Telly. So, yeah, that's our show. Thanks for listening, everybody.
And remember,
we'll be watching.